question in this election is really what kind of country we want to be and what kind of future we'll build together.
I think Hillary and I agree on that. We probably disagree a little bit as to numbers and amounts and what we're going to do.
And the kind of plan that Donald has put forth would be trickle-down economics all over again. In fact, it would be the most extreme version, the biggest tax cuts for the top percents of the people in this country than we've ever had. I call it trumped up trickle down.
We have to do a much better job at keeping our jobs, and we have to do a much better job at giving companies incentive to build new companies or to expand.
That means we need new jobs, good jobs, with rising incomes.
NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And now you want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate.
I have a feeling that by the end of this evening, I'm going to be blamed for everything that's ever happened.
Why not?
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, another week in the markets, and markets getting a little testy and unnervy with problems going on in Germany, troubles over Deutsche Bank. But according to our technician this week, Gary Dorsch, positive things are ahead, at least in the next couple months. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in Hour 1 will be Gary Dorsch, and he says as long as the Fed's on hold the next 2 months, it still means it's a positive outcome for the market. And certainly, we have not seen the drawdown in stocks as we typically do in September and October. Later on in the show, we will have Robert Rapier with us. He'll be commenting on the events that took place at that meeting in OPEC, talking about production cuts. And we'll be talking about some of the implications for the commodity markets going forward. What does it mean for oil? He's still sticking to his forecast that we may see $60 oil by the end of the year. You want to hear why? And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, the markets always seem to be concerned with the latest crisis du jour. The latest, of course, is Deutsche Bank, the crisis there. People are concerned about the solvency of Deutsche Bank, and hedge funds, as a matter of fact, have taken short positions. The real question is there a parallel to Lehman Brothers back in 2008, and what does that mean? If you notice, we seem to have problems that are systemic in nature that quite often people try to solve by tinkering around the edges, and as a result of that, we keep bouncing from crisis to crisis on an ongoing basis. Look over the last 8 to 10 years, and nothing's gotten really better. So what do we see for the future, given the fact that the systemic problems are better and the system are not being dealt with? And oh, by the way, over the last 3 months, we've been pointing to a U.S. economy decelerating, and it's really amazing. We have presidential elections right now. The things that people are concerned about, according to polls, are number one, the economy, number two, security, but that doesn't seem to come up quite often in the debates and some of the tit-for-tat spatting that is going on right now. So we'll take a look at that. We'll take a look at where we actually stand and what we'll probably see next year. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as a part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And sitting in this week for Ryan Poplava is Chris Sheridan once again, who hosts our FS Insider edition during the week. And Chris, as Jim just mentioned right during the opening there, obviously, and we're going to talk about this on The Big Picture, the big focus this week is on Deutsche Bank and people concerned about its solvency.
That's right, John. We saw a lot of volatility in Deutsche Bank this week. And as we mentioned 2 weeks ago, the price of Deutsche Bank has continued to fall, and that's been really putting investors and authorities on edge. And on Monday is when we saw a massive collapse in Deutsche Bank shares based on reports that Angela Merkel, Germany, would not step in and provide state aid if necessary. So that's what originally led to the fall at just in the start of this week. However, there was that big jump on Friday, and it was based on some rumors that are now circulating. Of course, I'm speaking on Friday after market close, so we may get more information as the weekend progresses. But at this point, there's speculation that Deutsche Bank and the Department of Justice have reached a settlement of around $5 billion for their role in packaging mortgage-backed securities and selling them out. However, there hasn't been any real confirmation of whether or not that is true. Some people are saying that this is not a firm settlement because under European law, anytime there is an actual definitive settlement of some type, the bank under question, and Deutsche Bank in this case, has to confirm that. Apparently, they have not done so. This may just be some volatility we're seeing with Deutsche Bank based on rumors at this point. So we'll have to see how these things transpire into next week.
Coming up shortly, we'll be talking with Robert Rapier about the energy markets activity there, particularly in relation to the OPEC meeting that happened. And how did that move the markets, Chris?
So, John, there have been some rumors that OPEC is going to agree to some production cuts, and those won't be taking place until probably November. So there's been a lot of movement in the energy markets in the price of oil based on whether or not this is going to take place, if all the members can agree to it. My understanding is that Robert Rapier does think that this is going to eventually happen. However, we do need to make a note that this production cut, should it occur, is going to be taking place when production is already at very high levels. So many analysts are saying that it's not going to do anything to necessarily solve the oil glut that we already see in play. However, that being said, rumors do move the market. And so we did see some volatility in oil this week, and West Texas Intermediate crude ended up closing at 48 and a quarter. So we're getting closer and closer to that $50 per barrel region. I do want to point out that we're going to be speaking with Roberto Aguilera next week on our program. He wrote a very, very well-researched book called The Price of Oil, and their forecast, it was co-authored with an individual by the name of Marian Radetzky, but their forecast is for an average range between $40 and $60 per barrel all the way out to 2035. So that's another almost two decades ahead of low oil prices, and that's based largely on the shale boom that's been taking off here for now many years in the U.S., and that's spreading across the globe. We see deals with British Petroleum in China to unlock their shale reserves. So they really believe that this shale boom is going to go global, and that's going to suppress oil prices for some time.
Of course, Chris, we've been in this. Will she, won't she raise interest rates again? I mean, we've been playing this almost every year now. But Janet Yellen, chair of the Fed, spoke this week as well at a conference. And apparently some of the things that she's said have been grabbing a lot of attention.
Yeah, there were reports out that Janet Yellen is now saying that she does see benefits to central bank stock purchases. So that has been leading to a flurry of headlines on numerous sites. Whenever she's mentioned this idea before, or if it's been raised, I believe it's always been from the posture of, that's not something that we want to do. It's probably not even legally possible. So she's really been pushing back on that idea. And so I believe this is the first time we're kind of starting to see hints that Janet Yellen, the Fed, is becoming a little bit more welcome to that idea. And here she says, if our economy were hit by a negative shock and the Fed needed to intervene to stimulate the economy, we have less room using our conventional overnight interest rate tool to do that. She said this on Thursday. We need a wider range of tools. And when it came to what those tools could be, she was asked about equities and corporate bonds. And she said, there could be benefits to the ability to buy either equities or corporate bonds. So now we see Janet Yellen opening up to this idea of, I mean, this is the same kind of policy that we see in Europe with the ECB. They're buying tons of corporate bonds. We see other central banks, of course, the Bank of Japan being one of the biggest, buying outright stocks. If the Fed were to move in that direction, and it seems that she is floating this trial balloon that we definitely could, should another downturn occur, that's really piquing a lot of investors' interests. And as William White, the former chief economist at the Bank of International Settlements, said on our show this Wednesday, that, you know, he really believes that central bankers are doing more harm than good at this point. So he had some very interesting comments that our listeners may want to hear.
And Chris, once again, I appreciate you sitting in for Ryan Paplava, and we look forward to seeing you during the week and back here again as needed. So, good weekend.
Thank you, you too, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Paplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Rebecca Rothstein. She's an expert in Pilates. And Rebecca, let's talk about Pilates in its origination, because a lot of people think that Pilates is an exercise for young women. But when Joseph Pilates invented the exercise routine and the machines, it's my understanding it was for rehab for men after World War I. Can you give us a little background on that?
Well, Joseph Pilates had actually been a sickly child, and he'd had all sorts of problems, including asthma. So people tend to think of his system as something that's just about creating flat abs, where in reality, he was doing it as a whole body health system that was initially helping him live a better, fuller life, and with an emphasis on breathing, for instance, as one of the key components in how people could live better lives in general. And then when he was in an internment camp in World War I, he was a German citizen and he was interned in the Isle of Man in Great Britain. He started working with some of the other injured soldiers. And through that, he started really developing the idea of how he could make people feel better and also recuperate, even those who couldn't stand, for instance. So his original population and what he was really designing everything for were men, which is really interesting in contrast to the perception that Pilates has today. Just as you said, that it's for young people, that it's for flexible people, for that it's for women specifically.
Well, typically around this time of the year, we see a lot of weakness in the markets. September and October have never been known for producing great results, but so far, the correction has been somewhat modest. If we look over the last 30 days, most markets, if they're down, are down a little over 1%. Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch. And Gary, let's talk about this typical period that we see. I've had technicians that say, you know, hold on, watch out. We could see a major correction here, as we typically do in the fall. But so far, if this is a correction, it's been a very mild one.
Well, historically, September has been the worst performing month for the stock market. And although we've seen some of the biggest crashes in history in the month of October, such as in 1987 and 2008 and a few other years where we've had some October crashes, October is not actually the worst performing month. It is September, and we've gotten through September. Basically, we are sitting right now almost exactly where we were towards the beginning of the month. The Dow Industrials right now at 18,283, and we were just around 18,400. So maybe down 0.5% this month, which is just a very small decimal to look at. Although October's had its shares of crashes, it's also been the bottom of a lot of bear markets. And then November and December and January, some of the best months of the year. So if we want to look at it from a seasonal point of view, the market's doing pretty well. And I think this year the rules are a little bit bent because of the upcoming presidential election, which is about 6 months from now. The general view in the marketplace, whether everyone has their own political views, of course, and their biases, but the general view in the market is that if Donald Trump was to win the upcoming election, it would be negative for the stock market, at least in the short term, due to the uncertainty of what his policies would mean vis-a-vis world trade, perhaps a little more protectionist policy than we have seen in decades, which could put a damper into world trade. And then on the other hand, a Clinton victory would be somewhat positive for the market, if nothing else, because we would see the Federal Reserve still completely under the control of the White House, where the Fed has become the fourth branch of the U.S. government and pretty much follows the dictates of the White House, as it has done for the last several years. So I do agree that Right now, the Fed is being very political. They should have raised the Fed funds rate several times this year, and I think they've deferred doing that for fear of knocking the stock market down ahead of the election. So the reason we're seeing a relatively mild reaction, I think, in the market is because the Fed is keeping the interest rates artificially low. And then we will see if there is going to be an increase by the Fed. It will be in December after this election is determined. We saw at the Jackson Hole meeting in Wyoming, Stanley Fisher went on TV with CNBC and told the market that he expected the Fed to raise interest rates twice between this year. And obviously that's not going to occur. And so there was some backing down. There were about six Fed members who had publicly called out and said they were in favor of a rate hike. We should have seen that at the last meeting, and they did not move. And that is, I think, primarily the reason the market is defying gravity, let's put it that way. So should we get a rate hike in December, then I think we'll do something that is abnormal again, whereas December is usually a good month. A rate hike in December could actually lead to a correction at that point. So my view is no Fed change in interest rates for the next 2 months, so the market can remain elevated. And we still have the buybacks. So they're going on all the time. Microsoft just announcing a $40 billion buyback over the next year or so. And this has been a corporate QE in itself, the buybacks also keeping the markets elevated. So I have not been negative on the market, actually leaning towards the bullish side over the next 2 months, seeing support for the Dow Industrials at the 18,000 level and a possible rally to 19,000 if Wall Street gets its favorite candidate, Mrs. Clinton, as the president. They may try a rally to 19,000. Now, if it should look like Mr. Trump is going to win the election, then all bets would be off. At that point, we would probably break 18,000 and drop into the mid-17,000 area or even slightly lower. So that is a wild card. And from what I can see, the election is very difficult to predict at this point. It's going to be extremely close, and it'll depend on turnout, which could blow all the polling data completely away, as we saw in Brexit as well. The polls for Brexit were widely off.
Let me stop you there. We've spent this whole year talking about whether the Fed was going to go. They raised last December. Then they said they were going to go four times this year, and they postponed it six times. Now, whether that's political or not, but one thing that I think a lot on Wall Street would say, raising interest rates when the economy is cruising at 1%, when the inflation targets are well below their estimates. And I don't see, at least from the fundamental data that we're following, Gary, anything that really stands out here in terms of robust economic growth. I know we had a Fed governor a couple of weeks ago when the market corrected and said that the economy was in danger of overheating. And I'm trying to look in the economy and say, where is it? I don't see it. We've had weak ISM numbers. The ISM manufacturing is now below 50, contracting, and the service sectors. So if they were to go and raise in December, what would be their reasons for doing so other than normalizing interest rates?
Well, my three major pillars of economic activity that I look at are, number one, auto sales, housing sales, and the labor market. People are confident enough to buy the big ticket items like autos and housing. That to me is extremely important. And then the state of the labor market. And now into the seventh, eighth year of an economic expansion, this economy is creating anywhere from 150 to 200,000 jobs a month. That's extraordinarily good given where we are in the cycle. Auto sales at 17 million a year on an annualized rate is at near record levels. And housing prices have rebounded dramatically, in some cases even above the 2007 high. So wealth creation through housing is there. And so once again, it's remarkable that the new normal is 0.375% for the Fed funds rate. And when you look at a 50-year chart of it, it's highly abnormal. And the reason I believe we should see rate hikes, and why, in fact, Mr. John Williams of the San Francisco Fed gave an interview just yesterday saying he thought that the economy could withstand higher interest rates. To me, it's the economy can withstand it, number one. And number two, you want to basically prevent the further emergence of bubbles in financial markets. And also we got a bubble in the bond market where interest rates are artificially and abnormally low. A lot of people are getting trapped into these bonds at very low yields, and that's going to be dangerous because when a time comes in the future when you do have to raise rates due to higher inflation, there's going to be a lot of people being badly hurt in both bonds and stocks. So the reason to hike rates and to normalize them a little bit, we're talking only from 3/8 to 5/8, it's still going to be abnormally low, is to look further down the road, take a medium-term view, and say, I want to head off the possibility of bursting bubbles in financial markets should the time come when we have to raise rates, should inflation pick up. If oil prices start to rise for whatever reason due to a war in the Middle East or some other events, or the dollar starts to fall for whatever reason, you would already have a little bit of insurance by having a slightly higher rate, even against that possibility. So that's how I kind of view it. And it's, I guess, more of a theoretical or intellectual debate, but I'm sure there's a lot of Fed governors who are itching to raise rates but are being restrained from doing so due to politics.
So, Gary, your view is probably for the next couple months, the Fed will remain on hold as long as they do that. It's an okay period for the stock market, but after that, come December, they may go. Now, let's take a look at some other markets. We had OPEC meet this week, and they agreed for the first time they need to cut back on production. Now, some figures were 200,000, which I don't think is going to do much, where others feel that if they really want to have an impact on prices, it would need to be a correction, let's say, in the neighborhood of 700,000 barrels. But if oil prices were to rise, that also might give the incentive of U.S. producers, especially shale producers, to crank up again. So we've got oil here that's been trading in the $40 to $50 range on the day you and I are speaking. It's on its way, or looks like it's close to $48. How do you see oil trending from here?
Well, this month we're going to see an increase in oil production coming from Libya and Nigeria. Those two oil producers had restrained production due to terrorism, which was disrupting their output. And apparently, with various agreements amongst the warring factions in those countries, production from those two countries are expected to increase by 800,000 barrels a day here in the month of October. And that was going to create a surplus of 2 million barrels a day for the world markets. So that was essentially why oil prices moved lower in recent weeks. And here we have now Saudi Arabia for the first time offering to cut its oil production. Of course, Saudi Arabia has increased its oil production by 1.2 million barrels a day since the price of oil crashed under 50 a barrel back in late 2014. So in any event, it is going to correct some of its output. It is producing at a record level of 10.7 million barrels a day, and Russia is producing at a record level of 11.2 million barrels a day. Russian oil output is up 400,000 barrels a day from about a year ago, so there's an awful lot of excess supply. Saudi Arabia at least making an attempt to cut back its output by a half a million barrels a day, according to this recent press reports. Of course, their main nemesis within OPEC is Iran. These countries have been at war with each other for quite some time and greatly distrust each other. Iran started the year at 3 million barrels a day of output, but once the sanctions were released, they have since increased their output to 3.6 million barrels a day. They wanted to get up to 4 million by the end of the year, so they apparently have made a concession. Iran has conceded from this article I read that it would limit its output to 3.7 million this year and falls short of its target by 300,000 barrels. And in return, Saudi Arabia has offered to cut its output by 500,000. That's a net cut of 400,000. And apparently there's going to be another 300,000 barrels a day of reductions from some other members of OPEC. We don't know who yet. We don't know the complete details of this agreement. This is a sketchy agreement that has so far been released, and we'll find out, I guess, at the November meeting who else is going to be making cuts. I'd also be interested to see if Russia is going to add to reductions in supply. Assuming the cut is only 700,000 barrels, I don't see the price of oil going much above 50. So last time we spoke, I had thought oil would trade between 42 and 50, and it's done so. a lot of that is simply by watching the futures markets. The spot market right now for crude oil is about a little over $47 a barrel. And if we look a little bit further towards the end of this year, December 2016, at $48, that's about a half a dollar above the spot market. And then 1 year forward to December 2017, trading at $52. So futures traders do see the price of oil between $48 and $52 as a result of movements to cut output. And I would think 52, therefore, would be about the upper level, and maybe it moved the bottom to 45. So not much movement there, because we'll still have an oversupply situation in the world markets. Now, should the Fed raise interest rates in December and thereby strengthen the dollar, that could have a negative impact on the price of oil, which could possibly knock it down to 45 a barrel. So that's sort of my outlook for the oil, neutral, but within that range of 45 to 52 for the next several months.
Let's move on to gold. Traditionally, the fourth quarter of the year is a very strong season for gold. You have the Indian wedding season. You also have Christmas jewelry sales. Gold has been holding above 1,300. I guess that's the good news. But it hasn't done much of anything during this weakness period. Your views on gold here?
Well, gold has key support at 1,300 to 1,310. Technically speaking, should that fall below 1,300, that would be a negative sign, and it would drop down to about the 1,250 area. I basically have been observing that the price of gold has been fluctuating along with other commodity prices. The year-over-year change in the commodity index has been a key driver. Right now, the equally weighted commodity index is trading at the 420 level, and that is up 8% from a year ago. So we have seen, generally speaking, commodity prices up on a year-over-year basis. That would point to an increase in inflation. So here's an indicator for the Fed to look at. Higher commodity prices could lead to higher inflation going forward. That's positive for gold. Should the Fed raise rates, however, and strengthen the dollar, that would be a negative. Since I don't see the Fed raising rates for the next 2 months, I would guess that gold is going to continue to hold above 1,300 and possibly rebound up to 1,350, 1,360 between now and the next 2 months. So I'm kind of keeping my forecast short because of all these different variables, including the outcome of the election. The election could have a very big impact as well as should Mr. Trump pull off an upset victory. And I see the bookies in London this morning only giving him a 36% chance of winning. That's down from 44% on Monday, given his very poor performance Monday night in a debate. But should he win and should he prevail, there could be a big shakeup at the Fed. We may go back to having a little more of an honest monetary policy with less political influence and could see higher interest rates. So I'm going to leave that as a variable to look at post November 8th. So outlook for gold, 1,300 support and resistance at 1,350. And I would be a buyer in the low 1,300 area and looking for a short-term rally to 1,350.
So, Gary, overall, you see whether it's, I don't care if we're talking about oil, gold, the stock market in general, a fairly good period over here over the next 2 months, given the fact that the Fed will restrain itself, unlikely to raise, if they do indeed, until December. And after that, if we do rally into that period, would you start getting defensive? What would you be doing? Would you be taking some profits and maybe wait for better buying opportunities ahead, or?
Longer term, I think gold has hit rock bottom. I look at markets also from a cyclical point of view over the longer term. It was in a uptrend for 10 years and a downtrend for 4 years, and I think the downtrend is now over as of this year. So any pullback in the gold market would be a buying opportunity over the longer term. I think we're eventually going to see higher commodity prices going forward, regardless of what happens. Even with interest rates, I'm a believer in looking at world demographics, and the world population is growing quite dramatically than we've ever seen before. Over 200 million persons per year on a net basis, increase in the world population, according to the United Nations, and they're expecting another billion persons on Earth in the next decade. So to me, that's a reason to buy commodities over the long term. That's inelastic demand and is not going to be influenced as much by anything in gyrations in markets. So to me, that's a bullish factor. And that's another reason why we may even see the bottom in oil prices as well and other commodities. So while they're depressed now, some point in the future, we're going to have much higher inflation just due to world demographic trends. So I would, yes, I'd be a buyer longer term. Once again, just a slight chance of a dip under 1,300 should Mr. Trump pull off a upset victory, and we could maybe see a shakeup of the Fed and a little tighter monetary policy than otherwise.
All right. Well, listen, Gary, as we close, if our listeners want to follow your work, why don't you give out your website, if you would?
Well, I do have a website. The address is globalmoneytrends.com. You can go there to see some articles that I post to the website from time to time. Take a look at some interesting charts and graphs, and that would be the best way to reach me at globalmoneytrends.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I believe we are on the cusp of a multi-decade bull market in the metals, and we are right now facing our first test of that theory. So writes Avi Gilbert, who joins us today on Financial Sense of ElliottWaveTrader.net. And Avi, before we get to your outlook on the metals, I want to first point out that we had you on the show a number of times in the past. And in 2014, while gold was trading at $1,300, you told our audience, "I don't yet think that the bottom is in." When we spoke to you again in early 2015, you said, "I still think there's some downside ahead of us and that it's likely to bottom later that year." And indeed, if we look back, gold did indeed bottom in late 2015 at $1,050. I know $1,000, that was a price target that you gave, you know, that gold could reach $1,000, perhaps even lower than that. And a lot of people thought you were crazy at the time. I remember some of the feedback that we got from your call of reaching that. But if we look back, late 2015, we saw gold indeed bottomed at $1,050. So right around that $1,000 target level. So given how accurate your forecasts have been in the past in terms of just when gold would bottom and around which price, I thought it'd be good if you could just share a little bit about your methodology, your framework, how you come to your forecasts for our audience, because clearly you're doing something right.
Thank you, Chris. Back when we called the top in 2011, it actually was based upon a 200-year Elliott Wave and Fibonacci mathematics study, believe it or not. And that gave us a high target that we hit within $6 of the actual high that the market hit back in 2011. Once that high was struck, actually even before that high was struck, we gave three potential targets as to where a long-term correction could strike. When we came to the first target, and that was around 2012 or so, I think, the market started developing in a relatively bullish fashion. So we started looking long again, but we were looking for a certain cue to be certain that the market had bottomed. We never got the cue, and the market started breaking apart from the bullish trend we were looking for. At that point, we had to then stop, turn, and then look down to our second target, which was in the 1,000 region, 1,000 to 1,100. That was the secondary target we had from a long-term perspective. And it was actually the evening we hit that 1045, for those that remember that night, I actually posted on the site, "I'm going in and buying big," and I called up our broker. Some of you guys may know him, Doug Eberhardt, who writes quite often on Seeking Alpha, and you know, we started ordering gold that evening, and we literally nailed the bottom in gold, literally within a dollar, I think, of the bottom. But, you know, generally, most of it is based upon Fibonacci mathematics, and the manner in which the markets move through those Fibonacci levels is actually quite impressive.
Well, for the last 12 months, we've seen oil prices trade within a narrow range, $40 to $50 a barrel. This week, there was a meeting with possible implications that OPEC may be finally cutting back its production. Joining me on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, let's begin our discussion with this OPEC meeting. Does it really mean anything? In other words, will they get serious? Because we've seen this in the past where they agree on production cuts, but everybody cheats and it doesn't materialize. So is this significant? And do you think they are coming around to the fact they need to stop producing as much as they are?
Yeah, I think the immediate supply-demand implications are not hugely significant. I think it's more significant and it marks a psychological shift and a shift of strategy. You know, it was 2 years ago, November 2014, that they'd lost a little bit of market share to shale oil producers and they decided they were going to defend market share. So, you know, what happened is the U.S. had put about 5 million barrels a day of new oil on the market over the previous, you know, 5-6 years. And then OPEC decided they were going to put more on the market. So, you know, people ask me what caused the price to crash. There were two elements. U.S. put 5 million barrels a day, and then OPEC dumped nearly another 2 million barrels a day on top of that. And their strategy at the time, oil was trading about $80 a barrel. It had fallen from 100 in the summer. And they believed, and I know this from reading comments that they were making at the time, they thought they would drive shale oil almost completely out of business at $60. So OPEC thought, we'll drive price down to 60, you'll see all this shale oil production shut down, and then we'll get our market share back. Interestingly, they had only lost about 2% market share at the time. I wrote an article for Forbes yesterday where I showed historically what happened after the 1973 OPEC oil embargo. They went from 51% market share down to less than 30 in just about a decade. And I think they were worried about that. They were worried that the shale oil boom in the U.S. is increasing at the most rapid pace in U.S. history. Oil production's increasing. And they didn't see an end to that. And they said, we have got to deflect that growth. And to their credit, they did do that. It did deflect the very strong growth. But it's hard to imagine that this had the outcome that they hoped it would. You know, shale oil production is down some, but 80% of it is still producing. So, you know, it caused a lot more pain for a lot of the members of OPEC. I mean, everybody suffered within OPEC. I wrote another article early in the year, OPEC's trillion-dollar miscalculation, because I believe it will cost them $1 trillion, this move that they made. And they may never make that up. And what it did, it forced U.S. producers to become more efficient. You know, they cut costs. They are more resilient now. And the cost of production has declined, the break-even cost for U.S. producers. So I think ultimately OPEC said, you know, well, let's shift strategies here and let's do something different. So the production cut they're going to make, I think it was a little over 700,000 barrels a day. It's what they announced. But, you know, they've increased by 1.8 million barrels over the past couple of years. In the U.S., we've declined around 1 million barrels a day. So if they follow through, it's a significant amount of oil coming off the market, and it will lead to balance a lot quicker than had been anticipated. The International Energy Agency had forecast that we were probably going to be second half of 2017 before the markets really started to balance. And I think this moves that up as long as OPEC follows through. And I think they're likely to follow through this time. I mean, they have tried to talk the price of oil up lots of times without actually having any action. And that hasn't worked. So I really think this is a shift of strategy for them. And that's the bigger implications is there more to come? It's just like in their meeting 2 years ago, it marked a shift of strategy and it resulted in oil prices falling and falling and falling. And so I think they're in the mindset now that they're not going to defend $40 oil anymore and they're going to push that price up as much as they can.
So, Robert, let's go back to U.S. shale producers. Assume they do cut back production and the price starts to rise. You mentioned earlier that the cost of shale production has come down. What is the break-even cost right now for shale producers? I mean, we've heard over the years it was 60, it was 40, it was 50. What is that price today?
It's all of those. I mean, it really depends. I mean, it depends on how much oil you get for your well. So they've optimized wells. They've figured out how much sand they need to use, how many stages they need to use. But it all depends. If you're in a very sweet spot of a play, I mean, you could break even at $30. Now, there's not a lot of oil that breaks even at $30, but there's some. But as oil prices move up, you can move out of those sweet spots and you can break even at higher and higher prices. It just means, you know, you've got oil wells that over time are not going to deliver as much oil, but at a higher price, they don't have to. So You know, I used to think that there was going to be a lot of resistance at $60, because I think that's the price that quite a bit of oil will come online. But it turned out, you know, there was a lot of resistance at $50. You know, we had a lot of trouble breaking out above $50. But I think we'll still see that. I think we'll have a hard time crawling up above $60 for the next few years until we see, you know, some of the fields that are being produced now, they're, of course, depleting. And we've seen oil, I think it's down about 1 million barrels a day off the highs. I think the first thing we'll see, if oil creeps back up towards 60, you'll see that decline start to slow down. But I think producers are going to be very, very gun-shy and very hesitant, and banks are going to be hesitant to go out and lend a lot of money. As oil prices go up, the production's not going to go up like it did before. We're not going to be adding 1 million barrels a day like we did before, because too many people got burned, too many bankruptcies. So I think the response from the U.S. is going to be much slower than it was the time before.
So let's talk about the industry itself. As you mentioned, there wasn't really as much of a cutback in production. A lot of these companies that had shale wells had to continue to produce because many of them were leveraged. They had debt. They had to meet those interest payments. So they had to continue to bring cash flow. Given the state of the industry today, where are we? You mentioned that you didn't think that we'd ramp up to the levels that we saw. What did we get up to? Something like 9.6 million barrels a day of production. We're down to what? Somewhere close to 9. So does this fact that we will not ramp up where we were, OPEC is going to cut back. They may do that in one phase. They may do it in a second phase. In other words, pursuing a tightening strategy on production. What does that mean for the industry itself? Can the industry make good money at $60? And I'm talking about some of the bigger companies that have these offshore platforms where we know it's more expensive to produce oil.
They'll make some money. It's not going to be like the $100 oil. I mean, for a company like, let's say, EOG Resources, they will make money, and they'll make decent money, I think, at $60 oil. They're one of the most efficient producers. A lot of their plays are in the very sweet spots of the shale oil fields. They'll make okay money at 60. They'll make money like they would have made, you know, 3 or 4 years ago at 80. I think they've squeezed, you know, $20, $30 a barrel out of their costs. Some of these guys, you know, I hold some ConocoPhillips from when I worked with ConocoPhillips. I don't think they're in nearly as good a shape because they do have a lot of production that's not in the shale plays and production around the world. And I think their break even is a little bit higher. So, you know, the guys, especially in the Permian Basin, the guys that are in the sweet spots of the Permian Basin, I think they are in the best shape.
What about as we look at the big companies, and one thing that we've seen, I'm just thinking a couple of years out from now, Robert, we've seen Exxon, BP, Royal Dutch, all the major companies cut back on, let's say, acquiring new properties, shelving projects that were in the pipeline, laying off employees. And we all know that when you start laying off employees, cutting back on production, given the time it takes to bring fields into production from new discovery, what does this mean or imply for oil prices down the road?
You know, I think ultimately OPEC learned a lesson here. And I think they learned not to screw around, and that shale oil is much more resilient than they thought it was. I think that has a bigger implication. I think that is something they're going to be very, very careful about. I think we are setting up. You know, it's like you spend a lot of time at one end of the spectrum or the other. You spend a lot of time at $100 oil, and you start to set up a serious swing the other direction. And I think we've done that now. You know, the rigs are not going to ramp back up rapidly here. We are setting up, you know, 1-2 years down the road, we're potentially setting up a swing high on the other side as production starts to, you know, fall short. I think for the next year, probably we work off these inventories, but a lot of this drilling has been stopped. It will start to show up in lack of production, you know, 2-3 years down the road. And that will swing oil prices, I think, to the high end. When it happens, you know, it's hard to say.
So looking at the industry, where they are today, what about these high levels of inventory that accumulated over the last couple of years? Won't that in some ways put a damper in terms of how prices can go? Because we still have to work off a lot of inventory.
Yes, absolutely. There is record high global inventories. Like I said earlier, the IEA was forecasting that it would be, I think the latest, they pushed it out to the second half of 2017 is when they thought we would start to actually get the markets balanced. But I think with this cut, I think you're going to move that probably in the first half, maybe first quarter of 2017. But there is a lot of oil in inventory. That's going to be, you know, kind of tap the brakes on oil prices.
So as we look at this, maybe we have some upward movement. Maybe we get up to 60 and maybe the new trading range becomes 50 to 60, where in the last 12 months it's been 40 to 50. In terms of value, where the best plays are, where do you see that? Is it in companies like EOG that are in areas where they can produce oil cheaply? Is it the big companies that have strong balance sheets? Where are the values in this marketplace given where we are today?
Yeah, so I wouldn't call EOG a value, but I own EOG. I think it's the best run oil company and shale oil company in the country. They're a little bit high on some of the, you know, financial metrics, but they perform and they continue to do very well. So I own EOG. It's done very well for me. We've recommended Apache, and, you know, they did announce a new discovery in the Permian Basin last month, and the stock price moved higher on that.
Robert, let me stop you there for a minute because, you know, the reports I read, it said something like 2 billion barrels potential. I mean, that's a major discovery.
Yeah, it is. Of course, you know, how much of that is oil, how much of it's gas? You know, I saw some people try to downrate it and say, yeah, but that's probable and all of that won't be produced. But it is a lot of oil. It was a major discovery. And stock price did move up pretty sharply on the news. And fortunately, we had recommended it before, so we got that movement. I recommended it because it has looked to me undervalued for a long time. The financial metrics for Apache looked very good. And from the February lows, it hadn't moved up like a lot of the other companies did. So that's one that we liked and recommended.
In the big companies, I know that I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Royal Dutch, all the major companies have cut back significantly, whether it's cutting back on projects, delaying projects, laying off employees. There's been a significant contraction in the industry. So where do they stand coming out of this if we indeed move to $50 to $60 oil?
Well, you know, the big integrated companies, they have the problem of the refining assets are not going to do well. So if we're actually in a movement to higher oil prices here and you really want to get the biggest bang, you know, the big companies are not necessarily where you want to be, the big integrated companies. I actually saw an article yesterday that recommended on the basis of this cut, Valero. Now, that's the worst possible place you want to be in an upwardly moving oil price environment. And I see today Valero's down 5.5%. So the market after hours yesterday actually bid Valero a little bit higher, which I thought was odd, but it is reacting like it should today. But of course, all these major integrated companies, ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, they all own a lot of refining assets. And so you will now see the refining assets start to drag on earnings. Of course, you know, if they've got enough upstream assets, you know, there's going to be a race here. You know, they're going to get more for oil and gas. Natural gas has moved up. They're going to get less on their refining assets. So in an upwardly moving market for oil, I would much rather prefer to be in a pure oil and gas producer rather than a large integrated company. But, you know, there is more risk there. If oil prices unwind back to $40, you know, the ExxonMobils of the world are going to see some benefit from the refining assets. So that's why for conservative investors over time, an ExxonMobil is a good place to be. For, you know, more aggressive investor that doesn't mind, you know, getting in and getting out, this is a time to be in a pure oil and gas producer.
So we have three categories. We have the large integrated, we have the pure oil producers, and you have some of the smaller cap stocks that are probably a little bit more on the risky side. Would you diversify between all three, or do you think maybe the mid-tier and the small tier is the place to be, given what's happened to this market?
You know, it all depends on your risk tolerance, but I would have been adding, and people I think should be adding if they have the risk tolerance, some of the smaller producers. Concho Resources is very attractively valued, and they are a pure Permian producer or focused primarily in the Permian. That's the place to be. I think that's the low-cost production in the Permian Basin. There are a lot of companies operating there, but, you know, there aren't a lot of values there because a lot of the financial metrics are bid up. But Concho looks pretty good within that group of companies. Debt is manageable. That's something else I'd watch. You know, debt won't be as much of an issue if we're strongly moving higher on oil prices. But as long as we hang around this area, you still got to watch the debt. And some of these guys still have pretty high debt loads. So, you know, at $80 oil, that's not a problem. At $40 oil, it's a big problem. You know, if we're moving up to 60, a lot of these guys will have a lifeline. Some of the guys in the Bakken, like Oasis, you know, they really dipped down. They got, you know, a little bit loaded with debt. That'll be a lifeline for them, I think. You know, a lot of the smaller guys, but you really have to have a risk tolerance for that. And I warn people about that. you know, if this is money you really need, you need to play very carefully with some of those guys.
And maybe if they were going to play that area, wouldn't it be safer to be in something like an ETF where you're not dependent on one particular company that could get itself in trouble?
Yeah, of course. But I mean, if you really want to experience a lot of upside, I mean, you can't do better than getting into one of these really good Permian producers in a rising oil price market. Because, you know, the ETF is going to have some drags on performance. I mean, I don't think the average ETF is going to outperform some of the small cap producers, like say in the Permian, that are in good shape financially. Again, like Concho, I don't think they will outperform a Concho. I'm just scanning year-to-date performance on some of these guys. I mean, somebody like Continental. I mean, I've got a table here that I did back in July, and Continental was up 100% year-to-date. But they're pretty high debt, so they're pretty high risk, and they had plummeted a lot from the highs of 2014. They went, you know, deep, deep hole. Apache was one of the better year-to-date returns. Concho was up at the time 32% back in July. I'd have to check and see where they are now, but I think they've continued to go up since then.
Let me throw out a possible risk. We've seen the IMF just came out this week. They lowered their global growth numbers for GDP down to below 2%, probably the worst that we've seen in an economic recovery. We have the U.S., which has been struggling to maintain even a 1% growth rate. We've seen economic numbers come down. What are the risks to oil if we head into a recession?
I guess if we went into a recession, demand for oil might actually decline. But the International Energy Agency, again, they made a lot of news last month because they lowered their growth forecast for oil. And that, as always, got translated into weakening demand for oil. And what happened is they said, we thought oil was going to grow by 1.4 million barrels this year. It's actually going to grow by 1.3. So they shaved like 100,000 barrels a day off of the growth. And that, as always, got mistranslated. Now, if you look back historically, that's still stronger than the last 30 years average growth. You're still adding more than a million barrels a day of demand. So I think that's what will happen. I think you'll see, you know, a little bit weaker demand growth, but it still means a year from now, we will need more oil than we need today. So, you know, with that and with the cuts in production in the U.S. and OPEC, you know, I think it leads to higher oil prices. I haven't given up that we'll see $60 this year, especially if OPEC follows through with the move. And I think they have their formal meeting in November. And if they come out of that and say, yes, you know, we are going to hold everybody to these quotas, I think you could see oil move on up to 60. If they come out of there and the agreement falls apart, you may see a retracement back to 40 until next year when it becomes clear that, yes, indeed, global inventories are coming down.
So right now, if I was to sum up, things are tightening. We've got OPEC possibly moving towards production cuts. U.S. producers will not ramp up to the level we saw before. So this might bode well that, let's say, oil enters a trading range from 50 to 60. Some of the mid-tier pure oil producers are probably some of the better plays to be in right now. So if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, Robert.
I write two columns a week for Investing Daily, one generally on master limited partnerships and one on the energy markets. I've got a subscription column over there called The Energy Strategist and one that I co-write called MLP Profits. And then I write a weekly column for Forbes. You know, I just got news out yesterday about the OPEC and what does it mean, and that got pretty good traffic. Apparently, people love OPEC misery, so when it sounds like OPEC is crying uncle, people love to read about that. So those are the main places. I write a few other places, but mostly at Investing Daily and Forbes. And for specific investment advice, that's at Investing Daily.
Well, did you notice all of the hand-wringing over the issue concerning Deutsche Bank? People are very concerned about its solvency. As a matter of fact, hedge funds have taken short positions in DB. Is there a parallel to Lehman Brothers back in 2008? But you know what we see is these events are becoming more and more frequent, and they seem to be systemic in nature, and tinkering around the edges is what people use to try to fix them. And as a result, we've seen them just bounce forward, one crisis right after the next, whether it's the pig crisis or the euro crisis or the Japanese crisis, we bounced. What does this mean, especially if we look at big exposures like derivatives, $650 trillion? That's breathtaking. happening. And we'll talk about that coming up next in the big picture. What do we foresee in the future since we're not fixing the systemic problems? And in the last 3 months, we've been pointing to U.S. economy decelerating, and it's amazing because while people are concerned largely, polls are showing the economy's number one, security, anti-terrorism is number two. A lot of the issues concerning these are not even appearing in the presidential debates. If not, why not? And what should we be looking for? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues, where it always is, at financialsense.com.